So, if you're not aware, we are starting tonight something which is going to take us the year to complete. And we've been having these digging deeper evenings now for two years or so. And once a month, looking more deeply at a particular biblical theme or passage or book. And this year, we felt we wanted to kind of string them together a little bit and give them a bit of a sense of cohesion rather than just jumping around random topics, which it wasn't quite like that, but it could have felt like that. And so the way that we tried to give some coherence to what we're doing this year was by deciding to follow through the, at least the titles of this book called Cafe Theology. Someone came to me in the week and said, do you want me to put out the tables and do the coffee for Sunday night? So if any of you are here under false pretenses thinking that this was going to be a very different evening to what it's going to turn out to be, then I apologize. The title is not to do with the style of meeting, it's to do with the book that we're following. Cafe Theology is written by somebody that's part of Holy Trinity Brompton, the church that Alpha originated in, a very large church in London. And fundamentally what it tries to do, it looks at 10 different topics which are kind of foundational to Christian doctrine and understanding. And if you've got the book, then you'll have looked through the index and you've seen what those 10 are. But we're going to follow those 10 through, looking at one a month over this year. There is the option, as many of you will know, of coming to a small group in between times to discuss what we do here on a Sunday evening. So the first of those small groups is on the 14th of February, where we'll be just informally chatting through tonight. So they're not highly programmed, there won't be a lot more teaching, but there will be just a chance to discuss and ask questions and put different perspectives and so on. So I think there's about 8, 9, 10 people signed up for that at the moment. So if you wanted to be part of that, all are welcome, but it would be helpful to know so we can get an appropriate sized room to meet in. Part of the challenge of what I'm doing tonight is that some of you will already have read the chapter in the book, maybe. Some of you might have bought a book to read after tonight and before the discussion group. Some of you might read the book and then come to the discussion group. Some of you might not want to touch the book and or come to the discussion group. So what I've tried to do tonight is to follow through some of the themes that arise within the book in this particular chapter on creation, which is where we start. But not just to reproduce what's in the book, because if you're going to read the book, you might feel shortchanged if you come to a session where I just stand here and read the book to you. So what I've tried to do is to use some of the subheadings and the titles and the ideas in the book, but develop them a little bit independently of the content that's in the book, so that you get a kind of double richness if you're reading. So it should make sense whether you just read the book and never come to another meeting, whether you just come to a meeting and never read the book, whether you read the book and come to the meeting, whether you read the book, come to the meeting and come to the discussion group, or whether you just read the book and come to the meeting and don't come to the discussion, whatever you do, I'm trying to make sure that you feel kind of, okay, that was worthwhile, whether it's just book, talk, discussion, whatever. That's my goal. Whether or not I succeed, we'll see. What I did on the handout, if you've got the handout, is I simply reproduced all of the headings and subheadings from the tonight's chapter, the book that we're looking at. That's the content. That's an overview of the content of the chapter. I'm not going to work through that, breathe a sigh of relief, but I am going to touch on some of those topics. I thought if you could see it, you could at least see what's in the book and decide whether or not you want to go to the chapter. And you can also, if you wanted to take notes, some of his headings on the sheet will also be my headings on the screen, even if I develop them differently. Actually, I'm beginning to think that the introduction is going to be more confusing than the talk. And the talk's pretty confusing, so enough said, I think. And in between times, a couple of times at least, I'll try and just shut up and give you a chance to talk to one another and see what you think about where we are at that particular moment. So, the chapter does start, hi Dave, the chapter does start in the book with him asking a very important question. And it relates to what kind of universe do we live in? And the way he puts it in the book is to ask the question this way. Do we live in a personal universe or an impersonal universe? Is the world the way it is because of it being shaped and designed in a particular way, or is it just there as a shape, as a result of pure random chance? Can we talk about purpose and meaning in the universe, or are we locked into a view of the world which is that everything that happened from the Big Bang onwards is just a matter of the unwinding of chance, which is what you believe if there's no person behind it all. And the Bible, from the very first statement, as many of you will know, and many of you will be very familiar with a lot of these themes and verses tonight, I'm sure, but from the very outset of the Bible affirms, sentence one, first phrase, in the beginning, God. That we're left in no doubt as to what sort of world we live in from the very first few words of Scripture. We live in a personal world where the language of design and the language of intention and the language of purpose and the language of planning, all those things suddenly make sense because of the first sentence in the Bible, in the beginning, God. An intelligent thinking being is offered to us as the root cause of everything. And that's a really, really important thing to grasp for all sorts of reasons. The secret of the universe is not a formula, but it's a person. It's not 49 or whatever the answer was in, what was it? I've never read the book, but yeah, I knew it was 40-something. 42. And it can't be found by scientific examination, but the only way we will make sense of the world is to enter into personal relationship. Not relationship with facts and figures and theories, but relationships with the being, God, who is offered to us at the very start of the story. And to make that point, the creation story in Genesis chapter 1, and we're going to look at three different creation accounts in the Bible tonight, time permitting. But in Genesis chapter 1, it's not just that the first sentence says, in the beginning, God, but the whole story is framed around the word God, which comes 34 times in 36 verses in Genesis chapter 1, should you care to count. So the word God comes 34 times in 36 verses. The writer of Genesis, and we'll come to who that may be in the due fullness of time, he is, and it probably was a he, sorry ladies, he is very concerned to establish the fact that this is God's world. You live in a God-created space if you live on this planet, or indeed in this universe. So, in the beginning, God says that God sits outside of eternity. Eternity, however we understand that, sits within God and not vice versa. There's nothing outside of God. Now, this is not a class in PhD philosophy or anything, metaphysics, so I'm not going to explore that too much, other than to assert that that's the picture the Bible paints for us. That outside of God, before God there was nothing, after God there was nothing. The Psalms puts it this way, Psalm 90 verse 2 says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. The whole shebang is somehow within God, not outside of God and God's presence. Now, Stephen Hawking, you know Stephen Hawking, the physicist, brilliant, brilliant person. He wrote a book a few years ago called A Brief History of Time, and he made this observation and asked this question. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? The usual approach of constructing a mathematical model cannot answer the questions of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to the bother of existing? Can you see the question he's asking there? He's saying, well, we can examine what there is, but we've got no idea why what there is. Maths and physics, even of the most brilliant kind, can't take us into that why question. It can look at possibly some of the how questions, but not the why question. And in his lovely book called The Living God, Peter Lewis says this in answer to that: Genesis and the entire Bible answers that question not with a what, but with a who. What's at the beginning of everything? Not a what, not something that can be mathematically deduced. Scientists, atheistic scientists, would believe that mathematics is at the heart of the universe. A Christian doesn't believe that. The Bible teaches that the Bible starts in a different place. So there's a person behind creation. That's the first point in the book, and I just want to start there myself because it seems to me where the Bible starts. And if we answer that first question differently, then the whole of the rest of the session and the whole rest of our lives look very different than if we come up with that answer. So let's just pause for a moment and look at some of the way that Genesis chapter 1 presents these truths to us. Genesis 1, of course, is the primary account of creation, the creation story. And I'm sure, again, we have looked at this, different ones of us, in different ways. But I just want to walk us through it again as tonight's session's on creation. It seemed a bit negligent not to look at Genesis chapter 1 together. Okay? Yeah, okay. So Genesis. You'll know that the phrase Genesis just means birth or genealogy or history of origins, the very beginnings of things. Who wrote it? Well, Jewish and Christian tradition ascribe the book of Genesis to Moses. You find in the book of Ezra that Moses is mentioned as the author, and Jesus appears to reaffirm that in Luke. It's not uncontested, but generally that's the way that it's understood. But it's quite clear that even if Moses did write it, he was drawing on texts which were later edited together, because if you look at certain verses in the book of Genesis, and incidentally, if you want to have these slides so you can look at all these things, we haven't got time to read them all tonight, but you can have the slides. You can see the hand of somebody else who's trying to explain what's going on. Clearly somebody later than Moses wrote bits of it to kind of draw out what Moses was putting in it for later readership. Now, why did Moses write it? Well, if it was Moses that wrote it, then we need to remember when he wrote it. And he would have written it. Remember, Moses was the leader of the children of Israel as they moved through the wilderness towards the promised land. They've just been released from hundreds of years of slavery in Egypt, and they were on a journey for the first time as a nation under God, if that's not an unfortunate phrase to use at the moment. They were a nation now, not a bunch of slaves, and they were under God, not under Pharaoh. And they were asking questions about the world that they had been indoctrinated into as slaves in Egypt, with all of the worldview of Egypt, the way that Egypt thought the world happened, with its various gods and divinities, and the Nile being divine, and the sun god Ra, and all of that. What kind of world do we really live in? How much of that can we really believe? Is that really where the world came from? The stories we've heard, the accounts we've been given, that we've heard from our Egyptian masters, do they really account for the way the world is and for the kind of people that we are now to be and the kind of God that we now serve as freed slaves heading towards becoming a holy nation? Those were the questions that they were asking. They weren't asking about the Big Bang. They weren't asking about where the dinosaurs went. They weren't asking about anything to do with contemporary 21st century physics. They were asking questions about identity and worldview, if I can put it that way. Who are we? What kind of world do we live in? What kind of God do we worship? How much of what we've been told can we believe? And if we remember how history, I'm just making this point because sometimes, certainly when I was a younger person, I kind of thought somehow, and it's just stupid, I mean, I thought a lot of things that were stupid, and probably still do, but, you know, the kind of Genesis was written almost like as it was happening, like creation happened, then somebody wrote it down, like really quick before we forgot what happened. And when I came to see that actually, you know, the world was quite a civilized place by the time this was written. It wasn't written just after some kind of primeval swamp had formed into, you know, all kinds of history had unraveled. We're probably talking about writing in the late Bronze Age. The pyramids were up in Egypt. Writing had been invented. People were quite civilized, relatively speaking. They didn't have iPhones, but you can't have everything, can you? So if it was Moses who was the author, we need to remember when he was writing it. Otherwise, we'll seriously ask the wrong questions of Genesis chapter 1, and we will kind of look for stuff that was never there. Typically, the questions of 20th century science and post-Darwinian evolutionary theories. They hadn't heard of Darwin, actually. He was a little later. If you're not great into history, just take that as a fact. So what were some of the accounts they might have heard? Well, they would have grown up in a world where there were many gods. Not one god, many gods. And those gods were a bit of a fractious lot. Their activity was born out of mutual mistrust, infighting, ignorance of the long-term consequences of their decisions. It was a bit more like a kind of a bacchanalian divine council rather than some sort of great serious court of heavenly judges who thought very wisely and seriously. They were squabbling, they were falling out, they were accusing one another of this, that, and the other. And the gods were sort of locked into warfare with the chaos of creation. They weren't in control of it, but they were kind of battling it. And nobody on earth quite knew whether the gods were going to win or not. So the world seemed a very capricious, unpredictable place. You never knew whether good or evil was going to win. And in fairness and in truth, if we were just to read off of the circumstances of our lives, what the gods, if that's what we believed in, were like, we might conclude something similar. If we only have our experience of life, we might say, well, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. Sometimes good things happen, sometimes bad things happen. And if we then read that onto a kind of family of fractious gods, you can see why you would conclude what they concluded. Which, incidentally, when Moses or the Bible asserts that there is only one God and he is good, it's not an obvious thing to say if you're creating that God out of your experience of life. Do you see that? If you wanted to create some fiction about the world, you wouldn't create something that seemed so far-fetched. The prevailing account sounded far more reasonable. So the world's disordered and unpredictable. And divinity is granted to things that you can see, like the moon is a god, the Nile is a god, the sun in Egypt was a big god, for obvious reasons again, perhaps. So divinity is given to created things. And mankind has a very servile relationship in all of this. We're just here to provide food for the gods. Doesn't sound a very fulfilling occupation, does it? But that was generally what we were thought to be here for. And occasionally the gods got really fed up with mankind, and they were a very noisy lot and disturbed their sleep and their slumber and their divine rest, and so they just obliterated them with a flood because they were far too noisy. I've had neighbours like that in the past, and it seems a bit extreme to wipe them out with a flood, doesn't it? But those were some of the stories about the way the world was and the way the gods and the heavens were that the Egyptians would have passed on to the Hebrews when they were their slaves. So how does the account in the Bible kind of mesh with that and address that view of the world and begin to give these freed slaves a different understanding of their identity and the place that they have in the world that they live in? Well, the way that Genesis chapter 1 is written is extremely, nuanced. It's very clever. We almost completely miss it in English. You have to be a Hebrew scholar, and so I'm relaying to you the fruits of Hebrew scholarship rather than what you can necessarily immediately read off of your Good News Bible or NIV, but some of it is clearly there. And the first thing we read is that the earth was, and I love this phrase, tohu wa bohu. Tohu wa bohu, which is translated as formless and void. It had no shape and it was empty. Lovely phrase. The phrase sounds like it should describe something far nicer, doesn't it? But it actually describes a sort of fairly empty space. Tohu, without form, shapeless. Wabohu, devoid of content. And what we read in the first chapter of Genesis is that little by little, the one God, in the beginning, God, created by firstly giving shape to a shapeless world. So he separates light and darkness. He separates, day two, the waters to form the sky and the sea. He separates, day three, the sea from the dry land and begins to create plants. What we see is this shapeless, formless place beginning to take shape in the way it's described in this narrative. And then, on day four, having given the world its basic shape, earth and sea, sky and land, he begins to fill it, addresses the wabohu bit. So the lights, or two great lamps, as they're called, to rule the day and the night, fill this separated light and darkness space. The birds and the fish fill this separated water and land bit. The water and the sky bit. And day six, animals and humans fill the day three separation of sea and dry land. Can you see how it's beautifully balanced and written so carefully? And we can just so easily miss it if we're asking the wrong questions or just reading with all of our previous understanding perhaps in place and not really paying attention to what's happening. And I haven't got time, and probably, you know, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, as you know, but if you're interested and you want to get some good books, Ernest Lucas' book's very good on this. Ernest has been here and spoken on this himself, hasn't he? But there are a number of books that really just help you see the richness of that kind of poetic language. It's unlike anything else in all of Genesis. It stands alone. And even if the latter parts of Genesis, the story of Abraham's family and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, describe history, this is describing something using poetry rather than historical language. The language is different, and that should alert us to that we're reading something. Of course, it doesn't mean that it's not true, but the way it's telling it to us, we should pay attention to. It's not coming to us in the same way as the rest of Genesis does. And on day seven, the heavens and the earth were formed and filled. And then we get this strange thing of God resting. He ceased forming and filling. Not filling in forms. Nobody ever finishes that. Maybe God does. He ceased forming and filling. Now, I may have mentioned this to you before. I think it's just really, really beautiful to spot what's going on here. That if you were to compare Genesis 1 to other accounts of creation written in other cultures at the same time, despite its many differences, and I'm going to come to those in a minute, there is one big similarity, and that is that it follows more or less the same shape that the accounts of God's constructing their temples follows in other ancient cultures. So if you were to find other pieces of very ancient literature where it's describing a God creating, what a God creates is a space for him to dwell in, a temple. And the Genesis account follows very closely the way that those other accounts go, particularly finishing with this idea of resting. Here's a quote from a book called The Lost World of Genesis 1. In the Bible, the cosmos can be viewed as a temple. Genesis 1 can now be seen as a creation account focusing on the cosmos as a temple. This is what makes day 7 so significant. Because without God taking up his dwelling in its midst, the cosmic temple did not exist. The most central truth to the creation account is that this world is a place for God's presence. Though all of the functions are anthropocentric, which means human-centered, meeting the needs of humanity, the cosmic temple is theocentric, God-centered, with God's presence serving as the defining element of existence. Now, I think that's, well, maybe you're there years ahead of me, but for ages I didn't know what to do with day 7. And day seven was like a reason for people to create commandments about what I couldn't do on Sundays. It's to do with Sabbath. Well, in a sense, it is all to do with Sabbath, but not to do with the way that Sabbath was interpreted when I grew up, which is that, you know, you could only listen to Cliff Barrows and Cliff Richards. You couldn't watch telly. Some of you remember those people. Some of you have no idea who they are. But, you know, there's a whole set of rules about what you could and couldn't do. But the richness of God resting is not that he stopped, but that he began to enjoy his engagement with his temple, where he belongs, where he dwells in his cosmos. And that contradicts the kind of view that God, kind of God's out there somewhere and we're down here. That this place is God-soaked. God doesn't dwell in temples built by human hands. Someone said that once. But God dwells in his temple. That's why he created it. He didn't create it as a space for humans to live in while he stood a little way off and watched how they got on. Creation is created because God wanted to live here with his creation. Not like some remote long-distance manager who sits afar off and sends commands or twiddles knobs and makes sure. No, the idea is that God dwells in this space, that this is where he is to be found. I'm laboring the point, but I don't seem to be communicating, or perhaps it's just very obvious. But it's a beautiful, rich thought. It's the point of the story. The point of the story is not where did we come from, but where are we, and in whose presence are we when we're here? Whose is this? Every bit of it. Every tree and leaf and fish and bird, whose is it? Who does it belong to? It's fantastic. So, the answers. Who is it written for? The children of Israel in the wilderness. Why? To establish their identity, their purpose, and the nature of the God who called them out of Egypt. How? It's written in highly structured poetic writing, reflecting but also critiquing other widely known creation accounts. So although there are similarities, there are also some profound differences. What are some of those differences? Well, I pointed to some of them already. There's only one God. That's the primary difference. That the universe is ordered by him. Structure. So I've just shown you. The universe is good and complete. It's good, it's good, it's good. The refrain of the days of creation. It's very good, day six. All men and women are made in God's image. Not just the gods or the kings, the pharaohs. Not just the wealthy, not just the rulers, all men and women. That in itself was so radical in that time, and perhaps still is, that every human being bears the image, even if masked and marred now. The earth is his, yet he invites humanity into meaningful partnership with him. So those are some of the reflections on the opening chapter there of Genesis 1. Just turn to the person next to you and tell them what you just heard. That you're interested in, that you're confused by. What did he say? Just 2 minutes. Okay, some of you have already run out of things to say, so I just wanted to give you a little sort of... I learned in the week the difference between... I can't even remember what I learned in the week now. But I learned what an amuse-bouche was. Do you know what an amuse-bouche is? There you go. See, this is separating those that know and those that don't. Those that move in fine circles of fine dining and those that don't. An amuse-bouche is... Pardon? Yeah, it's a chef showing off, giving you a little something on a spoon in between courses. You go to very fine restaurants, and in between courses, this little freebie will arrive. And it's not really to do with anything other than just a chance to sort of cleanse your palate and show off how clever the chef is. So that was your amuse-bouche for tonight. Okay, so it's nothing to do with how clever the chef is, but it's just cleansing your palate a bit. Now, the other really significant thing about creation, of course, very significant from Genesis chapter 1, is not just that God is in it and what it's there for and what the account is there for, but the way it positions humanity within creation. Deeply significant. Psalm 8, we know well. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you've set in place, what is humankind that you're mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. So the psalmist says, this is incredible. This amazing cosmos, this fantastic world with all of its design and beauty, and yet somehow, for some reason, and the psalmist, like you and I, knew himself sufficiently well to know that this was pretty amazing. God, this is something special about where we are in this whole thing. You made them just a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. All flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky, the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the sea. And you know how the psalm goes on. That's just the middle little section of it, where the psalmist just gets sort of explodes with wonder at not just the world, but because the world is so wonderful, how amazing that God should have chosen ordinary flawed people like you and I to bear some kind of special place within it. See, the psalmist knew what Genesis tells us, that although all creation is creation, there was something distinct about the creation of humankind. We're part of creation, but we're also, in a sense, distinct from creation. And the first two chapters of Genesis point that out quite clearly. So in chapter 1, we get this commandment. God blessed the human beings and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So in Genesis 1, we get this view of humanity as commissioned to oversee this incredible God-dwelling temple with him. It transforms the way that we think about the world when, incidentally, we remember that we're overseeing God's temple. It transforms everything about our environmental thinking when we think we're dealing with God's temple. The kind of way that we treat the world is not the way sometimes that we would treat Bristol Cathedral were we to go inside. And yet somehow or other we think, whilst it's acceptable not to throw our trash in Bristol Cathedral, it's okay to chuck it in the sea. If we thought of the whole world as God's temple, everything would begin to change about the way we think about the world. However, I digress, which I promised Myrtle I wouldn't do, but I've done that. So what you get in chapter 1 is this idea of dominion. We're here to exercise authority. God has given us that job. And you can see it. However many similarities, you know, what is it? 92% of DNA we share with a banana or something like that. You know, however much similarity between us and the rest of creation, it doesn't take, I don't think, a great intellect, but maybe I'm being unfair, to see that there are huge differences between us and the rest of creation. And part of that is accounted for by the way that we were formed and commissioned to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and to look after this place, have dominion. But in Genesis 2, we get a slightly different picture. So we get this very exalted view of humanity in Genesis chapter 1, but in Genesis chapter 2, we get a kind of an alternative. Here, human beings are not sort of created directly and given this wonderful mandate, but they're drawn out of the dust of creation. They're drawn out of the very stuff of creation. We get this second account of creation, which kind of enriches the first. So this quote, "The first human is made of the same stuff, the arable soil of the biblical hill country, as are all the other forms of life, and the divine breath blows into his nostrils is the same breath with which all the animals live and breathe." So whereas Genesis 1 kind of puts us as an exalted place, Genesis 2, if you like, brings us down a notch and says, don't get above yourselves. Whilst God has set his favor on you and his calling on your life, don't forget that you're not gods. There is a creator and there is a creation, and you're part of the latter, not one of the former. So there's an element of dependence, a strong element of dependence that comes through that account. But then within that as well, thirdly, there's this idea of being called to be part of the development of the earth. It's implied in that first of these three slides. But it says, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it." Abad and Samar in Hebrew, apparently. Now, the interesting thing about those words is that till it, on its own, simply means garden. But when those two words come together elsewhere in the Old Testament, they're often used in the context of priests performing their function of guarding and keeping the temple. We find it later in Leviticus, for example. So we get this idea that we're being called to care and to protect and to honor this place as though we were priests in this great temple that God has created. So these three ideas of dominion, dependence, and development are all found in these verses from Genesis chapter 1 that I've already read to you. Being made in the image of God. That's the distinct thing. That's what sets us apart. But what does it mean? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Well, here's a little video from my favorite people, the Bible, whatever they call themselves, Project in America, on what it means to be made in the image of God.
So if you lived in ancient Bible times, odds are you lived under the authority of a king.
And many of these kings claimed that they were gods, and they would even call themselves the image of God.
Meaning they had authority to tell people what to do, order things to be made.
Yeah, they got to define good and evil. And these kings would often make statues of themselves, which in Hebrew were called tselem, often translated as idol or image.
But for Israel, they didn't view their kings as the God. In fact, they were never supposed to even make images of God.
It's exactly right, and that was really unique for that time and culture. This is rooted, first of all, in Israel's belief that you can't reduce the Creator God down to any one thing in creation. But there's another reason. People aren't to make images of God because God has already made images of himself.
When did he do that?
Well, let's go to page 1 of the Bible. And the first person we meet there is God. He's the one with authority over all creation. He speaks and creation obeys. And he defines what is good and not good. In other words, he alone is king. But then surprisingly, as the pinnacle of all of God's creative work, he makes humans. And he calls all of them the image of God.
So he gives all humans the authority to rule.
Exactly, that's what he goes on to say. He tells the humans to subdue the earth and to rule it. And so this task that once belonged only to elite kings is here in the Bible the task of every human being. This was a revolutionary statement in its day because all humans are being called to rule and to participate in the human project.
So what does this mean? I mean, how are we all supposed to rule?
So the picture we get in Genesis is gardening.
Gardening?
Yes. Gardening. So they rule the earth by cultivating it, by harnessing all of the earth's raw potential and then making something more and new out of it.
So growing food for each other.
Yes, but that also includes growing families then, which become neighborhoods, and then they create communities where people are going to work and take care of each other and build businesses and cities that will expand to new places and so on.
So ruling is really the day-to-day acts of our work and creativity.
Yes, we take the world somewhere. This is humanity's divine and sacred task.
Yeah, and this all sounds really nice. And humans have designed some pretty great things. But just as often we create things that cause a lot of suffering and a lot of injustice, so maybe we shouldn't actually be ruling.
Huh? Yeah, so the Bible addresses this. In Genesis, what happens is that God gives humans a choice about how they're going to rule. So are they going to use their authority for the benefit of others, which is God's definition of good, or are they going to turn away and define good and evil for themselves and use their authority for self-advantage?
And in the story, they choose to define good and evil on their own terms.
And so this is the Bible's depiction of the human condition. So sometimes we pull off amazingly good stuff, but just as often, despite our best intentions, we act selfishly and we create evil in the world.
And so we're stuck as mediocre rulers making a mess of things.
But that's not the end of the story. So the Bible goes on and it makes this claim that all of this was resolved when God bound himself to humanity through Jesus. And he showed us what it looks like to truly rule as a human.
So what does it look like?
Well, Jesus ruled by serving and by seeking the best for others, by putting himself underneath them and loving not just his friends, but also his enemies.
And that's not a typical way to rule.
And not only that, Jesus confronted the consequences of all of the evil and the death that we have created by our messed up ways of ruling. And he takes it. I mean, he lets it kill him. And so when the New Testament writers looked back to Jesus' resurrection, they see a whole new future opening up for all humanity.
Jesus is a new way to be human.
Yeah, that's why they call Jesus the image of God, or the new human. And not only that, they also believe that Jesus' divine life and power is now available to heal and to transform us to become our life and power.
And this sounds really nice, but what does it really look like?
So practically, the Apostle Paul said it looks like people being filled by Jesus' own presence and spirit, filled with love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and integrity and gentleness and self-control. He says this is the new humanity that God wants to create in us so that we become people in whom God's image is being restored, people who will move the human project forward. And that's actually how the story of the Bible ends. It's a renewed world where God is on his throne and his servants are all around him, but they're the ones ruling over this new world, taking it into new, uncharted territory with Jesus as their healer and their guide.
Clear? They're beautiful, aren't they, those videos? The trouble is, when they're so good that you think, I'll just show them the video and go home. It's 7 minutes and we're done, you know. It's just if you have not seen them before and you want to go looking, it's called The Bible Project. They've got their own website and they're on got a YouTube channel as well. And they do 7-minute-ish snapshots. They've got the whole Bible now, every Bible book, and lots of Bible themes. And don't look at too many because otherwise I'll have nothing to do in a digging deeper session. But so they make this great claim that being made in the image of God is to do with what we do every day. There are many theories, and over the years, I've taught others, and you may have come across others, about it. We're made in the image of God means that we can think like God can think, or we can feel like God can feel, or we can love like... But if we... I hope you spotted it, the Bible itself makes the connection. Being made in the image of God is about being in the commission to rule. Read it again, Genesis 1, 26. It's about being given the mandate to develop, and as they put it on the video, to take this place somewhere under God in the way that God wanted. It's often been noted that the Bible starts in a garden and finishes in a city. And that journey of creation, of culture, is the meta-narrative of Scripture in terms of human development. We were never supposed to stay gardeners. The inevitable fact of being given this whole earth to develop and care for under God was that cultures and civilizations would develop and human ingenuity and skill, whether it's needlework or painting or music or tech or whatever would somehow be brought together under God to harness this world, harness all the potential and to make it something beautiful. So, they mentioned in there the significance of Jesus. I want to look at a second creation account. You might think, well, there's only one, the book of Genesis, and we've done that. We now know everything there is to know about Genesis 1 and a little bit about Genesis 2. Of course, you don't. But Colossians. Let's just go to Colossians for a minute. Colossians, it's been said, contains the richest descriptions of Jesus in the whole New Testament. If you want to just be soaked again with the glory of Jesus, then read the first two or three chapters of Colossians. It's just a rich, rich painting of who Jesus is. And these words are taken from Colossians chapter 1, describing the Son, who is the image of the invisible God. Notice that again. Point was made in the video, but Jesus is the image. He's what it should have looked like if Adam and Eve hadn't blown it. He's what it should look like if you and I are to be the image of God. Jesus is the prototype, the template, the image of God. The Greek word is icon. And you know, if a painting that's an icon is something that you see and you look through and you see what lies behind it. It's a kind of a focus for meditation, for deeper truth. Jesus is the icon of God. As we look and stare at Jesus, we see the Father who stands behind him, who sent him. Does that make sense? No, not at all. I switched off. Let me go back. The Son, who's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and to him. Or some versions say for him, to him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to him all things, whether things on earth or things on heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I'm sure you know those fantastic words describing Jesus. And if you look at what I've tried to show you on the screen there, is that the way this is written is in two halves with a hinge in the middle. So the first half, starting with the words who is the image, describes Jesus' relation to creation that we've been talking about. Everything was made, everything in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or thrones, all things have been created through him and for him. Now that's an enriching of our appreciation of creation immediately. So we get a very rich understanding in Genesis 1. It's God's temple, it's where he dwells. But now we realize that all of this was made for his Son and through his Son. Again, it immediately undermines any attempt that we might make, wittingly or unwittingly, to sort of abuse and misuse and mistreat and undervalue the created world. It was all made for him, by him, and through him. But then if you look at the second half of the statement, it starts with the same who is. Who is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead? Pointing now, of course, firstborn among the dead, to Jesus in his resurrected form, not in his initial pre-incarnation form, but in his resurrected form, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. And I've just picked out in different colors there so that you can see the same language is used in the first half as the second half. So you can see the in him, through him, to him bit in red. You can see things in heaven on earth in green, and you can see all things in purple. And there are other things where we had more time and more colors that I could have picked out as well, to make the point that what's being shown here is that the significance of the hinge, the bit in the middle. The bit in the middle is what glues the two halves together, obviously. That's what bits in the middle do. And the bit in the middle says that he's before all things, in him all things hold together. All of creation is for Christ, and he's the head of the body, the church. It's joining together that the rulership of Christ over everything with the rulership of Christ over the church, and saying it's the same Christ. old creation, new creation, or put it a better way, original creation and new creation, first half, second half, Jesus is at the center of all of it. It's all for him, through him, to him. He is its significance. Well, what is all this, how does all this map out? Well, are you still feeling strong? You cope a few more minutes, can you? Because we need to make a connection here between the way that Jesus is described and some thinking in the Old Testament from the book of Proverbs about wisdom. So in the book of Proverbs, similar language that's used by Paul to describe Jesus is used to describe wisdom, capital W, almost like as a thing. Here's the passage. The Lord brought forth as the first of his works before his deeds of old. I was formed long ages ago at the very beginning when the world came to be. When there were no watery depths, I was given birth. When there were no springs overflowing with water. Before the mountains were settled in place. Before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the world or the fields or any of the dust of the earth. I was there when he set the heavens in place. When he marked out the horizon on the face of them. When he established the clouds above and fixed securely the foundations of the deep. When he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was constantly at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. Who? Wisdom in the Old Testament. So this idea that there was a companion who was the, if you like, the means by which almost that God brought all of this into existence. Before anything was, wisdom existed. And so, from an Old Testament perspective, we get this idea that wisdom is God's agent in creation and the way that he preserves the world. By wisdom, the Lord laid the earth's foundation. By understanding, he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge, the watery depths were divided and the clouds let drop the dew. Humanity is called, as we've seen, to be God's vice-regent in running creation. Therefore, if you follow the logic of that, if you're going to stand any chance to run creation right, what do you need? Thank you. Four of us are still awake. That's wonderful. Wisdom. Wisdom is the attribute that's needed. You need to get wisdom. If you haven't got wisdom, there's no hope. My son, the Proverbs writer writes, do not let wisdom and understanding out of your sight. Preserve sound judgment and discretion. You need to be wise. You need to have wisdom in your life if you're going to actually work out how to live in this world according to God's calling to be his image bearer. That's what you need. You need wisdom. But because the New Testament, I'm sorry this is complicated, but I'm excited anyway, as you can tell, so just fill up with it for a minute. Because the New Testament picks up that language of wisdom but puts a different name in it. The name Jesus. He was the one who was beside his Father when creation was created. He was the one who was before the seas were formed and so on. So Paul picks up the wisdom idea, and John does the same thing, incidentally, very similarly in his gospel, and applies it to Jesus. Saying, no, wasn't this sort of vague thing called wisdom? You need to be a wise person. That's what you need to be. You need a little wisdom. No. Paul's take on it is that Jesus is the embodiment of wisdom. Jesus was God's agent in creation and preservation of the world. In him, all things were created, heavens on earth, visible and invisible, the thrones and powers, rulers and authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. It wasn't this vague thing called wisdom that anybody can have. No, it's a very specific thing, if I can put it that way. The embodiment of wisdom, Jesus. Therefore, if we are called to be God's vice regent in running creation, what do you need? Yeah, you knew. That's the right answer. Yeah, safe. Well done. Therefore, Jesus, if I can put it this way, is the attribute we need if we're going to actually do this. There's no hope of running this world wisely if you're not submitted to King Jesus. There's no hope of running our lives wisely if we're not submitted to King Jesus. There's no hope of handling our finances wisely if we're not submitted to King Jesus. Because Jesus is the wisdom of God by which the earth is run. And therefore, if we want to run in the earth, we need to receive his life and submit to it. Jesus is the attribute needed by humans to equip them in this task. So Paul says, so then, just as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him, strengthened in the faith as you were taught, and overflowing with thankfulness. Since you've been raised with Christ, new creation, set your hearts on things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. So Paul, just like the writer of Proverbs, says you need wisdom, so don't let wisdom slip from your grasp. Paul wants to say, no, you need Jesus. Don't let Jesus slip from your grasp. If you want to live in this creation and honor its creator, then understand for whom it was made, by whom it was made, and for what purpose it was made, and receive him into your life. Then, and only then, will you begin to get the hang of what's going on in the world and how to live here right. Does that make sense? I think that's beautiful. Tom Wright, you knew you couldn't get through a whole digging deeper session without me saying that. In his commentary on Colossians, he says this: the pre-existent Lord of the world becomes Lord of the church in order to become Lord fully of the world which he's made, but which has rebelled against him. Notice that in order to. So Paul, in that Colossians passage I had, he starts off by saying, everything exists because of Jesus, through him, to him, for him. Now he's become Lord of the church, and everything is now for him. But Tom Wright makes the connection there and says, in order that, not so the church can now be a happy huddle in the world, living wisely under King Jesus, thinking, isn't it great? We now know how things tick. No, in order that the image of God can be carried into your office and your neighborhood and my home and my neighborhood, that something of the lordship of Christ, which is now received by the church, overflows back into the world, and the images of God can do what they were supposed to do back in Genesis, which is to begin to order this place according to the wisdom of God that looks very like Jesus. Yeah. Okay. Just turn to the person next to you and say, what did he say? And then have just a couple of minutes. Anybody got any questions or comments that anyone wants to throw into the whole group before we just move into the home straight? Anybody want to throw a hand grenade into the arena? Sue's had enough. Anybody want to? No? Okay, happy for me just to finish things off. I should have said, I think probably you did notice, that the words in the blue lozenge at the top relate to the headings on your handout and the sections in the book. So if you've been ticking things off, you'll notice that we have actually looked at aspects of several of those subheadings, some of which overlap anyway. So let's just look at one more theme and thought around creation. And that's this, that creation is there to praise its maker and to reflect his glory. Paul says in Romans, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So Paul is quite clear about the status of creation. It says kind of a mirror in which, if you pause and consider long enough, you can't help but begin to think there must be something behind all this. There must be more than this. As you stare at the sunset or the stars or contemplate a human eye or an embryo forming into life, there's enough about life for all of our scientific age and our understanding of some of the hows and why and wherefores of some of these things, which still strike wonder in our hearts and make us think beyond the world to the Creator himself. John Calvin, which is not a phrase I use very often, but John Calvin says this: there are innumerable witnesses in heaven and on earth that declare the wonders of his wisdom. Not only those more arcane matters, for the closer observation of which astronomy, medicine, and all of the natural sciences are intended, but also those that force themselves upon the sight of even the most unlearned and ignorant peoples, so that they cannot open their eyes without being forced to see them. I couldn't possibly disagree. But, you know, it is a great leveler, isn't it, actually? If you're stood on a high place somewhere and you're looking at some fantastic view or you're seeing a sunset, it doesn't matter whether the person actually has got a PhD or whether they've got virtually no understanding and they've got some sort of impairment or some kind, the impact is pretty much the same. In fact, I would suggest the PhD person probably struggles to receive the impact more because they're probably trying to analyze at what angle the sun is setting and penetrating the dust in the upper atmosphere to create the, yeah. So what does it mean that creation is there to reflect the glory? In what way does creation reflect the glory of God? Well, just three brief thoughts to finish from history. So St. Augustine, he said that the thing in creation that reflects the Creator is actually the rational thinking mind. The fact that we can think at all is a reflection on the intelligence that lies behind the world, that our minds, in some senses, reflect the glory of God. And of course, the fact of the matter is that were the world not a rational place, science would be impossible. The only reason science works is because the world has some degree of regularity and uniformity about it. It's not complete chaotic randomness. Here's a quote from David Atkinson. The Christian says that the laws of physics are a reflection of the faithfulness of God, the lawgiver, and we can understand them because that same God underlies the rationality of our minds. The world is a rational place, and we have rational minds, therefore the two things can come together. If either wasn't true, if we had a rational mind but the world was chaos, then science could do very little, because if every time you measure something, it's different next time, and everything's like that. Well, you know, the world couldn't exist, could actually like that, I don't think. On the other hand, if the world was a very rational place, but our minds couldn't comprehend it in any way, then again, we'd be in a different place. But the coming together of the two is what makes science possible. I don't know if you know David Atkinson. He's one of these incredibly bright lads. He's got a PhD in astrophysics and a PhD in theology. And he resides in Durham at St. John's College. And I met him a couple of times. He's a very nice man. And he's a Methodist, so there you go. And he, a Methodist minister, as well as everything else. If you go into his study, along one wall, you've got all these fantastic pictures from astrophysics, all these wonderful pictures of galaxies. And along the other wall, you've got all these pictures of Homer Simpson. Just thought you might like to know that. I don't know the particular reason for that. But those seem to be his two great passions in life. But he's a very clever man. And he's written a number of books on the interface between science and faith. And he writes you can actually understand what he writes. He's a good guy. But that's what he said. He said that the Christian says the laws of physics are a reflection of the faithfulness of God, the lawgiver. And we can understand them because the same God underlines the rationality of our minds. So that's one thing, the rational mind. Now, another great thinker in Christian history, Thomas Aquinas, he was big into the ordered nature of the world. So not our rational minds, but now the world being such an ordered place. That's one way in which it reflects the glory of God. Genesis 1 forces us in the same direction. Here is a God of order, not a God of chaos. Here is a God of caring control, not of complete liberty. Let all the atoms go where they want. No, bring them together. David Atkinson, again, from his commentary on Genesis. So he's not only a double PhD, he also writes commentaries, Methodist minister, Simpsons, I don't know how he does it all. Anyway, that very ordered nature is what makes science possible. The whole enterprise of science rests precisely on the assumption of an ordered world in which pattern can be discovered and categories established. The ordered rationality of the world, deriving from its transcendent rationality of the creative word, is a basic assumption, not usually expressed in those terms of natural science. You bet it isn't usually expressed in those terms. There would be no science at all without an ordered world, he claims. That there's something about God's glory that's reflected in the very ordering of the world that we live in. It tells us something about God and the way he is. Now, both of those are sort of quite cranial, aren't they? And I want to put this two more things in here. Firstly, I think we need to wrestle, and there's a section in the book on this, that the world tells us something about the beauty of God. We don't often use that phrase. You know, we think about the rationality and the order and the power and the logic and all of that. But actually, the sheer beauty of God. There's that lovely psalm, isn't there, to say, I want to go into the temple and behold the beauty of God. And my root belief, one of my root beliefs, is that if we don't think God is beautiful, then we will struggle to serve him and love him as we should. If we think there's anything ugly about God, then the God that we're following is not the God of Jesus Christ, and we'll find it very difficult to be a disciple. Beholding the beauty of God is one of the primary tasks of basic discipleship. If we can't say, you're beautiful beyond description, and I stand in awe of you, then something is not going to work for us. He will be the Father who gives a stone when we ask for bread, or a snake when we ask for an egg. But he's not that. He's a beautiful God. He wouldn't do that. And so there's something about creation which, as we reflect on it, it reorders the chaos of our lives. And it reminds us that at the heart of all of this, there is someone who is beautiful. And next month, we're going to be thinking about the fall, and I know there's ugliness in the world too. But the essence of the world is that it's good, 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 because it's made by a good, good Father. And a little poem by Wendell Berry. Have you ever read any Wendell Berry? Have you ever eaten any Wendell Berry? I don't know. Wendell Berry's an American poet. He's a farmer as well. He's much loved by Eugene Peterson, who wrote the Bible. But it's a little poem. It's just reflecting on how reflecting on creation kind of reorders life in a certain way. It's just a very short poem. It's called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their lights. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. It's a lovely little poem, isn't it? Because the world is a beautiful place, fundamentally, despite the ugliness, fundamentally, there's enough there to remind us that we live in a world created by a God whom we can trust and who's beautiful. And my last thought, I suppose connected in a way, that what does it mean for the earth to create, to reflect the glory of God? Well, I think there's something about the extravagance of creation that reminds us something about the random extravagance of God, the generosity that there is in the heart of God. Jesus said, didn't he? I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Why should we do that? So that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. There's something randomly, gratuitously generous about God. to the undeserving and the least deserving. And just another poem, if you can bear two poems on a Sunday, by Phil Streeter, called "You're So Extravagant, Jesus." I won't read it all, because some of you look like you need your beds, but I'll read a little bit of it. It says, "You are so extravagant, Jesus, unbelievably extravagant in everything you do. You made a superabundance of things that are considered of little value. How many cast a second glance at sunrises and sunsets, yet both go flaunting around the skies like women parading new dresses? How many of us bother our heads about a field filled with varnished buttercups? We can't eat them, yet you find buttercups so cheap and fascinating to produce that golden carpets flop around everywhere. Then there are those huge heaving seas. Why so much water, Jesus? We can't drink it. And all those snowflakes endlessly parachuting to earth. Why send so many? And why each one a different shape and pattern? Sheer extravagance. No, Jesus, you're by no means economical. Even a picnic on a hill resulted in 12 baskets filled with leftovers. When Mary of Bethany was extravagant in her worship of you, people cried, 'Economize!' You said, 'This woman's extravagance will be praised and remembered forever.' Yes, my younger brother, you're beginning to glimpse a hue in the rainbow of my character. Creation demonstrates my extravagance and may be considered outlandish, preposterous, yet it symbolizes my love for you." Just go and look at a field of buttercups. Just look at the random, gratuitous generosity of the God who created everything, including the useless things, the beautiful things, the captivating things. And it's something about his reflected glory that we pick up when we see that extravagance. So there's much more we could have said, as always. But I just leave you with those thoughts, really. Walk around the world looking for the reflected glory. Walk around the world thinking this is God's temple. Walk around the world thinking this is for Jesus and to him. And see what difference it makes to live in creation, honoring the Creator. Let me pray. Father, I thank you for your word. It's so rich, sometimes it overwhelms us. And yet, Lord, we submit to it again tonight. And we're grateful for what it tells us, that we don't live in a world and universe of random chance under the domination of capricious gods who one day would harm us and one day would bless us. But we live in a world created by the one good eternal God who outspans even the word everlasting. Jesus, we live in your world, made for you, by you, to you. Both old creation and new creation. Father, we live in your temple, the place for your praise and glory, a place that reflects your glory. Father, we live in bodies and in lives that have been commissioned to bear your image in the world, to develop this place under your wisdom and under the calling of Jesus Christ. So, Lord, out of all of the thoughts tonight, those that are not helpful, Lord, may they wash from our spirits, but anything that maybe would encourage us to live just that little bit more distinctively, faithfully, trustingly, wonderingly in this new week. Then, Lord, impress that on our spirits, I pray. We love you, Lord, and we love to live in your world. And we love that there is one true God who is the beginning and the end and who one day will renew this creation and invite all those that love him to live in a place where there's no more grieving or crying or mourning or pain. For the old order of things will have passed away and all things will have been made new. We bless you, Lord, and thank you for your word, your truth, and we commit this new week to you. May we find you in it in all sorts of ways, we pray. In Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.